I'm concerned about living with children in a happy way that helps them to develop their potential, because I feel like God gives us these children to raise and we take this as a responsibility, and yet it's a task that we really know very little about. What we tend to do as children is to raise them the way we were raised, or perhaps rebel against the way we were raised and do something in the extreme, in the opposite. I kind of like to ask a question. How many of you feel that you turned out so perfect that you would like your child to be just the same as you are? I don't see anyone's hand raised, waving madly in the air. People feel that way. You know, like, I really want my child to turn out better than I am. I want him to be happier. I want him to use his gifts more than I'm using them. I want him to be kinder, more loving, blah, blah, blah. On and on. And yet, we seldom take the steps to change the patterns that we know and to learn new patterns of working with children. And maybe that's, you know, you're maybe making some attempt to do that by even attending a session like this, because you think maybe you'll get some new ideas for what you're doing. Unfortunately, I think what happens so seldom is we don't run for help until we're in trouble. You know, we wait, and I'd like to get, I wish I had known, for instance, what I know now when I started being a parent, which was, I hope to do a great deal better with my grandchildren, you understand. I'd like to start with a premise that has dawned on me just in the last couple years, trying to put together what I've learned in the secular world with my own personal theology, which I think we all develop over the years. I have come to believe that maybe our worst sin as human beings is that we do not accept God at his word, that we are of inestimable worth, of such great worth that his son came to die for me, not just for all of you, but for me. Now, I think most of us believe that on an intellectual level, or we wouldn't become members of churches. We accept that fact, yes, I do believe Christ is my personal Savior. But I really wonder sometimes how much we really act on that we really accept it on an affective level, on a feeling level. You know, see, cognitively it's easy to say, yeah, I can believe that. But I think in the long run that most of us are accepting all sorts of messages from people out in the world that say you're not skinny enough, you don't smell right, you're the wrong color, your hair isn't, you know, it's too straight. I won't ask for a raise of hands, but how many of you did something to take the straight out of your hair and make it curl in the last month? See, you know, the way the Lord plans your hair is not what society wants out of your hair, so you change it. And that's a very superficial aspect. It's much more important on a deeper level of how you accept yourself as a human being and whether you feel like you're good or not. Now, you know, how did we get that way? Did we get that way because God tells us, you know, you're only good if blah, blah, blah? The Matins this morning fit right into this. Did you all hear Matins? You know, she spoke to this idea that we become dependent for our self-esteem on our behavior. If our behavior and our appearance and our what we do on the job, perhaps, is acceptable to other people around us, then we can feel okay about ourselves. But if it isn't, then we don't feel good about ourselves. I don't think there's anyone in this room who hasn't experienced feelings of being less than you want to be in a certain group of people and wanting to get away from that situation. Now, the problem with little kids is they can't do that. They can't get away. If you're being a parent who's always giving put-downs, the child is stuck with you. You know, he's stuck with you until he's about 8 or 10, and then he starts staying away from home as much as he can. By the time he's 16, he gets a steering wheel in his hand. You're not going to see a lot of him if it's, you know, terribly uncomfortable, unless he's gone the other direction and is squished. You know, that can happen too, that a child is just completely squelched and spends the rest of his life at home. I have a friend who is, in his 40s, and finally the parents moved out of the family home. I kid you not, and left this adult with the family home. That was the only way to get Johnny to to grow up and leave home. No, this is a child who couldn't do it. Well, why? You know, how do we get that way? Well, the research, the evidence seems to show that self-esteem begins forming at least at birth. I don't know if anybody's done any studies about whether self-esteem is already being formed in utero, but I kind of suspect that maybe it is already being formed before birth. But it certainly is formed during the early months. The new research that's been going on with infants, which I think people sort of took infants for granted for a long time. You know, if you fed them and changed their diaper once in a while, that was fine. And I know when my kids were babies, we went through a period where babies were carried around in these plastic things, you know, and there's some feeling now that probably wasn't what babies need. That's okay if they're asleep and so on, but when they're being held, they need to feel this warmth and so on. I think these new baby carriers are marvelous that carry the newborn right here. So it's just outside of where it was before and can still feel that heartbeat. And that must give a feeling of security and of knowing that my environment hasn't changed that dramatically. By the time a child is around 7 or 8 years old, the self-esteem is pretty well set in concrete. It's kind of like potter's clay. Have any of you been down to the pot shop and made something out of the clay? You know, when you first were given that hunk of clay, it was totally malleable. You could sit there and push it around any old way you wanted and make anything you wanted out of it. But when you came back to it the next day, it wasn't quite as easy. Then you had to take a tool and kind of scrape away at it. It was what they call leather hard. And you could still take some away, but it was pretty hard to add to it. And if you added to it, it kind of broke off as it dried. And after it was once in the kiln, then it's set for life. As long as it hasn't been fired, you see, you can still pour water on it, put it in a plastic bag, and it'll soften up again. And I guess if you're comparing clay to human beings, that pouring water on it would be like going through therapy of some sort. You know, you can change. We can all change, no matter how old we get. We are capable of change. But it takes a great deal of effort. I wish that society valued the early years more. I feel like our culture does not value the early years of life. We assume that anybody who's born female automatically knows how to take care of little kids, and we put people in daycare centers at $3.45 an hour or whatever minimum wage is right now. And even parents come in and say, well, you know, I had a mother say to me one time, what do we need these girls with their fancy degrees for? They, you know, they're just babysitting. Well, I'm sorry, but we need people in daycare centers who are doing more than, quote, just babysitting. We need people who really know how self-esteem develops and how intellect develops and how spirituality develops and all the various facets of human development, because those early years from birth to 3 are the most crucial years in human development. You and I are a product of what was done to us in those early years, much more than any other time in our lives. And from 3 to 8 is the next most important segment. So if you've got kids in those age levels, I hope you're starting to quake and tremble. It's really a formidable task. And yet it's a delightful, exhilarating, inspiring, fulfilling task. And maybe it depends on how you look at it. But let's consider a little bit then what self-esteem is all about and if it's important, why it's important, and so on. I'd like to recommend to you, before I forget, a book which is over in the bookstore that I think does a really good job of explaining this. I'm very concerned about the proliferation of so-called Christian approaches to child rearing on the market today, because a lot of the stuff I don't really feel is all that Christian. It's a very authoritarian, sexist approach where father makes the decisions and mother's supposed to carry him out and everybody toes the line and that's the way you develop good family life. I take a dim view of that. I think we're no longer living in a period of time where we can have one person in the family shoulder the big responsibility of deciding what everybody else needs to do. I think that we live in a democracy, and if we're going to maintain a democracy, it is highly important that we develop people with very strong egos that can make good decisions, who learn how to evaluate and stand on their own two feet rather than being swayed by what the group is doing or listening to some strong leader who has a lot of charisma and sweeps them off their feet. This is exactly what happened in Hitler's Germany. I mean, people are asking questions now. Why didn't I do, have you read Albert Speer's book on Inside the Third Reich, I think is the name of it? He spent 25 years in Spandau prison as punishment for his part in the Nazi, the Nazi era in Germany, and was had a very high post as armaments minister for a long time. And his 25 years in Spandau, he sat there and thought about, why did I do that? Why didn't I see as I went along? Well, it had something to do, I think, with his upbringing, that you do what you're told. Children are here to listen, and they don't ask questions. They do what Papa says. And that was very much the child-rearing methods in Germany in that time. In fact, even after the war, Herb had a job with the Lutheran World Federation, and I went over to see that. And I remember children sitting in these refugee camps that just absolutely blew my mind, because they sat just jammed together like you'd never get a group of American kids without all kinds of poking and snarling around. And they sat stock still on these hard little milking stools, that people used to use in the old days to milk cows before automated milking. And it just, squashed together 100 kids in this little tiny room. And when the teacher asked a question, their little hands shot up like this. And I thought, my word, they're so... Now, that's one way of raising kids, and it raises obedient kids, and they're obeying through fear, but it also raises kids who will follow the leader, and that presupposes that the leader is worth following. And in that case, you see, the leader wasn't worth following, and nobody noticed that until it was much too late. So that's one reason, but I think the main reason that I want to raise kids without that authoritarian business, and we'll talk more about that on the third day, is that it does not develop strong individuals. It does not help people to develop their own potential. And I really feel strongly that if God created each individual, that He expects those people who are supporting that individual through those early years when we're so dependent to help that individual to achieve self-actualization, which is the highest need that human beings have. So let's look at what self-concept is made up of. Maybe you've got some ideas of how you feel this. What do you think self-concept is? What does it consist of? What's your definition of it?
Well, it's your own self-picture, your image of yourself, probably developed not only by what you experience, but your reactions to it.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a real good label for it, self-picture. It's your image or your visualization, your concept, or to put it very simply, your picture of who you are. Yesterday, Larry talked about this in the session that he had. when Moses said to God, "Who are you?" He said, "I am who I am." Now somebody says to you, "Who are you?" What do you answer? One year when we were here, we left the session in here and we went up to the lunch table, and I was sitting next to my husband, and he was sitting next to a lady and then her husband. And he said to my husband said to this lady, who are you? She answered that question by saying, "My husband is a banker in Peoria, Illinois," or wherever it was. I thought, she's nothing. She is only something in relation to her husband. Now, maybe that's a good way to raise ladies, little girls, so that, men can achieve their potential. We should all support them. I know my mother at 87 feels very fulfilled because she spent, 50 years or more serving the pastor so that he could do the Lord's work. And she felt she was doing the Lord's work by keeping his closet full of freshly ironed white shirts and having his meal on the dot of 6 o'clock, no matter that meant she had to leave her committee meeting and dash home and whatever. There was no give and take in that relationship, and yet she feels fulfilled in that. Because in that day and age, that's what ladies did. Now, you can decide for yourself if you think that's a good way. I feel like it's shortchanging society, because I feel like my mother had a great many things to offer that the world never got. She had all the gifts I have. She had all the gifts my daughter has. And yet her ability to give those to the world was limited by her role as a female who saw herself as, her main picture of herself as being someone who kept the house and who had all these things done, and she did them well, she did them properly, and she feels fulfilled with that. And I'm glad she does, because I don't. And I think that I'd like to do that. I feel fulfilled being a homemaker, and I certainly enjoyed raising my four kids. But I've got other gifts that I would like to share with the world. And especially at this period of my life when the kids are raised, that frees up an awful lot of time, that I'd like to do more than that. So that's one aspect of self-concept or self-image. The first part of it that children probably get, the first feeling of who they are, probably comes from body image. So that would be number one part of self-concept, is body image. What do you think of your body? Do you think of yourself as a fat person or a skinny person, a beautiful person, an ugly person, an average person, a person who's athletic? A young person told me the other day, I could never, ever let myself go like that. And this was a 23-year-old looking at somebody in their 50s and saying, you know, and I thought, well, I'll be glad to see when you're 50 if you still have this same image of yourself as someone who is physically fit. This at 23 is very important to this person. But the body image comes from not only how I look, but how capable am I physically? How do my muscles function? Am I somebody who has good small muscle control, good large muscle? This is another thing that I have a personal bias against our culture, is that we have such a high value for physical sports, as though that's the, what do you listen to in the evening? News, weather, and sports. Why isn't it news, weather, and entertainment, which would be sports, drama, music, poetry readings? Do you ever hear about the poetry readings in your town on the TV news? I never do. See, that isn't valued in our society. If you're a poet, you really have to scrape along to earn a living. But if you're a football player, you can, look at the baseball players, demand humongous sums of money and even strike when you don't get it. And society is supportive to that. To me, that's incredible that, that we value this one segment of entertainment so highly above all the other areas of entertainment. So if you aren't good physically and you're a male, were born a male in this society, you may have your self-esteem diminished. But that depends on whether your parents value sports. Okay, the second aspect then of self-esteem is your social self. How do you feel about the way you relate to other people? If you're a teenager and you're a boy and you talk to girls and they all kind of giggle and move off, you may feel like you're not too hot socially. But if they sit there and go, at you, then you may think you have a very good self-concept of yourself. It's your feeling about your relations with others. Are you a party girl, a pretty girl, a popular boy, a hero, a dummy, somebody who doesn't know your way around? You may feel perfectly good in your own situation, and you get into a different situation and you feel just like nothing again, because you don't know the rules in this situation. If you have high self-esteem, you'll probably say to yourself, I don't know the rules in this situation. How do I learn that quick? But if you have low self-esteem, you'll try to move away from that situation. All right, the third aspect then of self-esteem is your cognitive self. This involves feelings of security and having control over your world because you understand it. And this is one reason we send kids to school. The more you understand how the world works, the better you can feel about it. You know, in the ancient days, they thought that it was the gods who made the thunder and the lightning come, and if you'd been naughty, you might get zapped by some lightning or something. Now we know there's a whole different aspect of that, and we kind of know not how to control lightning, but at least how to stay out of its way. I can give an example from my own self-development in the cognitive self. When I first started teaching, the first few times that I had to have parent conferences, I just drove to school with, you know, fear and trembling, because I really felt these mothers were going to come in and say, okay, now what are you doing with my kid? You know, why isn't he achieving more? You're not a very good teacher. But after I did that for a while, I began to realize that the mothers were coming in with fear and trembling saying, is he okay? Because their self-concept was dependent on whether this child was being a good child or an achieving child in the classroom and not misbehaving, and whether this child was going to be ready for first grade. That was always a biggie with these kindergartners. Will she be ready for first grade? This helped me a little bit, because I began to see that they saw me as an authority figure, an authoritative figure. So I didn't need to be afraid of them. But the thing that mainly did it was that I learned more about child development, that I could begin to really give them good information when they came to me. And I knew how to ask them for good information, so that our exchange became a quality exchange and not something superficial where we were sitting there and fearing each other. But this development and my feeling of being a good teacher came only as I learned more about how to be a good teacher. The fourth part of the self picture then is self-esteem. And I think this is the part that maybe parents play the biggest role in. The other three that we've just talked about, the society around the child outside of the home has a great deal to color that picture, especially after the child gets into school. But self-esteem, I think, is the thing that we do the most good or damage to, depending on how we handle it. And I think this is the part that comes mainly from our religion. I started out by saying I wanted to establish a basic premise, and I think I strayed from that a little bit. I feel very strongly that if I can really accept God at His word, that I have this inestimable worth, that I'm so worthy that His Son came and died for me, that then I should be able to accept myself and not listen to all the things you're telling me. So that when we leave this session, if I feel like, gosh, those people didn't get anything out of that at all, I can see they're getting bored and some of them are going to sleep and nobody finds anything worth writing down, or they're not going to come back tomorrow because this wasn't helpful. I can either say to myself, ooh, I'm a really lousy teacher. I shouldn't be doing this because, you know, I'm no good. Or I can say to myself, you know, I don't think I was quite where they are. I wonder how I can find out how to meet their needs better. And maybe meet with some of you on the side and ask you some questions. You know, how did I miss this? Now, did I talk too much and not give you a chance? Or was I talking about a subject you already know about? Or why wasn't this meeting your needs? You see, if I've got low self-esteem, I'm going to blame it all on being no good. If I have high self-esteem, I'm going to say the situation was wrong, and being the person in charge here, I need to find out a way to correct that, if that's possible. And if it isn't possible, then forget it. I had a situation that I can use as an example for that. This spring, I was asked to teach a class in curriculum development. And I was asked to go to a daycare center and teach this class. When I got there the first night and started teaching the class, I discovered that I had everybody that worked for that daycare center in my class. I had the cook, I had the secretary, I had the two ladies that drive the vans to pick the kids up, I had the aides, and I had the assistant teachers, and there were three teachers. Now, you know, out of that class of 18 people, there were three people there who were responsible for curriculum development, which meant 15 of them had no use for the information that I was, you know, assigned to bring to them. Now, you know, that is really a situation where I found that I was really failing. After the third week, the director of the thing called me and said that she had received some negative feedback. She'd like to discuss it with me. Her proposals were, would I be sure to leave it out on the dot of 9 o'clock, not 3 minutes after, because some of them were dependent on a husband or someone picking them up, and they didn't want to be late. The second thing was that be sure to have their coffee break, which I had done. The third thing was, that did they really have to have homework? Because, you know, they work so hard all day, and this was, did they really need to? And so on. Well, she went on with a list like that, and finally I said, you know, every one of those things is pointing out one thing to me, and that is a lack of interest. You know, they really are not interested in what's going on in that course. And I said, I feel quite helpless because I was asked to come and give this course. This is my assignment for my superiors, and yet I don't feel like it's anything they either need, want, or are interested in. And they're showing this by saying, you know, I want to be let out on time. I want a longer coffee break. I don't want any homework. The coffee break was supposed to be 10 minutes. That also I had no control on. That was dictated from the higher-ups. But they were used to being at the school that I was sent from, where it takes you 5 minutes to get down to the coffee break room and 5 minutes to get back up. So your 10 minutes is used in moving back and forth. Then you need an additional 10 minutes to drink the coffee. So you see the coffee breaks ended up being 20 minutes. And they were used to that, and they wanted 20 minutes in their center, which was crazy because we were. It'd be like, you know, the coffee would be right here, and you'd want 10 minutes to get it and come back to your seat. So much for that. I did not take that personally, believe me. I was a little bit angry at being put into a position like that. So self-concept is exactly what this lady said. It's how we feel about ourselves. We decide if we're going to be successful or if we're going to be failures. And we decide that on the basis of whether we feel like we can be successful or cannot be successful. There are two real basic convictions on which we base our self-esteem. And these are things that were taught very, very early in life. And I think these are things that both are biblically based in a positive way. The first conviction is, I am lovable. Now, you know, if God sends his son to die for me, am I lovable or am I not lovable? You know, there are no strings attached to that gift of grace, are there? None whatsoever. It's not based on whether I'm the right sex or the right height or color or shape or whatever. It's just absolutely unconditional. So I need to feel that I matter simply because I exist. Not because I'm pretty, because I behave the way my mother expected me to behave, which I did, of course. But however, I did not behave the way my father expected me to behave. So that could have, you know, gone into that. Not because I'm smart in a family where being intellectual is a valued thing, or because I'm a good instrumentalist or a good ball player where that's a valued thing in the family. I can be the one who is different. I had a mother tell me one time she was so glad when she got some input from the school on what kinds of toys to choose, what kinds of things to do with the child. She asked, she said, Christmas is coming, I've got some money here for toys. I really don't know what to get at this stage. This is child number one, of course. And knowing her little child, I said, why don't you take a big box and go down to the stationery store and get some good scissors and some paste and some construction paper and some drawing paper and some potter's clay, and went on with this sort of thing. And she said, well, that all sounds very exciting, but I wouldn't have the faintest idea what to do with it after I got it home. I said, well, why don't you let him lead the way? You know, by the time Christmas comes, he'll have been in nursery school long enough that he'll have some ideas of what to do with every bit of that stuff. And maybe he can show you, which is a real big self-esteem booster for a little kid. And she did that. And later on, she came back and she said that was the best thing that ever happened to that family. Winters in Minnesota are very long. It gets dark early. You know, by the time you have supper, maybe it isn't quite time for kids to go to bed, but it is pitch dark and freezing cold outside. So what do? Watch TV? This, she said, my husband is the kind of man who does not know what to do with a child until he gets old enough to throw and catch a ball. And they happened to have a little boy who was not good at that. So if that was what father's relation to the little boy was dependent on, you see, they had a problem. And this apparently helped solve that problem. They now had something they could all do together, and they discovered they all sort of thought it was fun. It was different. You know, Daddy hadn't used a crayon since he was 10, and he suddenly discovered crayons again. There was something in life besides throwing a ball with children. Okay, you know, sometimes we need to follow the child's lead and see what the child is interested in. I think we got sort of a royal scare with our kids because neither of us are outdoor people. I mean, we love to be up here because you can sit and look at the outdoors, but then you can go in and sleep in a bed and take a hot shower. But when we got up here, we discovered that our family broke neatly in half. We had one kid who felt like we did and who, you know, pretty much slept in the chalet, we had three other kids who went bananas. The first time, well, I guess the younger one, the two younger boys had Boy Scouts, and that I was grateful to them because they provided an outdoor experience that we didn't go canoeing and camping and backpacking and all these things that a lot of parents teach their children. It wasn't something that Herb and I particularly enjoyed. But the three youngest really enjoyed that, and they'd come up here and put on the backpacks and disappear for 3 days and come home having walked 40 miles in the wilderness, and it was grand. Well, I don't mind walking up to Cloudy Pass as long as I can get home and go to bed at night. But I don't want to sleep up there. You know, I'm not saying anything against it. I think it must be marvelous if you enjoy that, but I don't. So it's super to have you know, other people help, so that I don't have to say to my kids, that's not worthwhile to do that. I remember one time our daughter came in just in time on Sunday night for Sunday night service, and I said to her, oh, hurry up and get clean because it's just time for church. And she said, oh, she said, I really don't think I can go. She said, it would spoil it for me. I've been communing with God for 3 days out in the trail. And she said, to put it in a formal setting would spoil it for me tonight. I don't think I can go. Now, you see, and I had to accept that. There's another way to worship, and she'd been out with a young seminarian and his wife, and they had just had this beautiful experience on a totally different level. So, in order to develop this concept in your children that they are lovable, you've got to believe it, and you've got to believe that it is not dependent on behavior. And then you've got to ask yourself, does my child feel loved? There's a real big difference between you loving the child and the child feeling that you love him. And I think what gets in the way of that is mainly our own self-esteem problems. It was a long time before I realized that I was getting far too much of my ego out of my kids doing well in school. Boy, it was neat to go to teachers' conferences with those older kids. I discovered this, I think, before the little one got sucked into it. But with the two older ones, it was just a delight for me because I came out with a head about this big. You know, they were doing real well. Well, then we moved to Minnesota, and it was a real big switch because the IQ level in their class suddenly rose probably by about 20 points just for moving from one state to another. And at the first conference that we went to, the teacher said, I don't know what to do with your kid. If somebody walks down the aisle, he sticks his leg out, and he's throwing spitballs and so on. And I was just devastated. This is my little boy misbehaving like this in school. What am I going to do, you know? And I suddenly felt like a bad mommy because I had a little boy who was misbehaving in third grade. What was I going to do? Well, fortunately, we had these conferences, and as we talked it out, we began to realize that this little boy was feeling really out of it because he had moved from another state. And he didn't know how to bridge this gap, how to become one of these kids. What the way you were looked up to socially in his class in the other state was to be the one who misbehaved. That's who was looked up at and up to in that class. So in order to be socially acceptable in his new class, he tried that. This is what he had learned in his own school, old school. And so he tried that in his new school. And it wasn't working, but he didn't realize that yet. So the teacher said, well, you go home and tell Mark that the children that are valued in this school are the children who do well in their studies. And she said, he won't have any trouble with that. So we went home and told him that. 2 weeks later, she sent a little note home that said, I don't know what you told your kid, but he's 100% improved. And that was the last we heard of that. So, you know, the value of talking together is what I'm pointing out. But what I mainly wanted to say to you is that this was devastating to my ego because it was dependent on my feelings of whether I was a good mother or not a good mother were dependent on that child's behavior. Now, that's a terribly heavy burden for an 8-year-old boy to carry. You see, and that also does not do anything for his self-esteem because he's valued if he's a good student, if he behaves well, if I get good reports from the teacher. Otherwise, the value is not there. Now, I hope I didn't get that across to him. And, you know, maybe that feeling in me was only part of it and that I did value him. I hope I feel like I valued him in spite of the behavior. But the problem is that even though I felt that I valued him, regardless of the way he behaved, it may have come across to him through what I said, and my reactions of feeling a strong put down by the teacher to myself, you see, that he wasn't valued. He may have felt a lack of value when I came home by the way I handled it. So it's real important to watch your child and ask yourself very carefully, does the child feel valued? The second part of self-esteem is that I feel capable and worthwhile. I feel like I can cope with my environment. I can handle myself in the environment that I find myself in capably. I have control. Now, you know, this may sound to you like it's not biblical. Yesterday, our scripture readings, how many of you were at the Saturday night session that we had with John on what the meaning of the scripture reading was? Well, we remember yesterday, last night, he said the consensus was that God is in control. And I think as Christians, we mostly feel that if we can hand the control of our lives over to God and find his way for us, we'll make it. But you see, that so the feeling of control comes in that I have found God's way for me, and I am doing that. For some reason or other, we often feel like we got to take that away from kids. You aren't capable of that until you're 18. Is that right? You know, so we take the control away, and we decide what the child is going to do. We'll talk more about this when we get into discipline, but there's real clear evidence that children are capable of controlling themselves up to a point from the very beginning, and that it's when their ability to control leaves off that we need to come in and set limits. And that's a real difficult thing. I think that's the most difficult task in parenting, to know when you need to set limits and when you need to let that child control it himself or herself. That's the most difficult task. Some parents go off the deep end one end and don't give any limits or controls whatsoever, and the child just founders, because what that says is nobody cares enough about me to set any limits. Some people go the other way, and they know exactly what they're going to do for that child in every aspect. We're okay with newborns. We let newborns sleep when they're sleepy. We feed them when they cry and they say, "I'm hungry." We diaper them when they're wet. But it seems like very shortly we begin to decide when they're going to eat, how much they're going to eat, when they're going to go to the toilet, and where and how, and when they're going to go to bed. All of these things, I think, are controlling children at, you know, in ways that they don't need to be controlled, have helped to make us into people who are not controlling ourselves well. Like, you know, I wonder, again, I won't ask you to raise your hand. Is there anybody in this room who has never gone on a diet because you don't know how to control your eating? You know, why do we have so much trouble eating just what we need? I think a lot of it has to do with the way we were raised in the early years. And I'm watching this working with daycare teachers, where we give rewards to children for eating a certain amount that we have determined, instead of teaching children to listen to what their insides are saying about how much to eat. We decide. In the public school system in our town, every child is automatically given so many ounces of protein and so many ounces of milk and so many ounces of green stuff, and, you know, it's all there, and they get it on a tray whether they need it or not. And it assumes that every child who is between 6 and 12 needs the same amount. Now, you know, do you believe that we all need the same amount? You know, I mean, everybody here who's between 23 and 60, do we all need the same amount? Or, you know, when you talk about being fair, I don't need the same amount that I did when I was raising my kids. I could eat anything I wanted in those days. Now I can eat about this much. It's disgusting. You know, I don't dare go in that snack bar. I put on 5 pounds before I leave here. Every time I take a trip, I come home and I'm 5 pounds overweight. Why? Well, I go into a restaurant and I order lunch, but it's 3 times as much lunch as my body's requiring. And then I have to say to myself, do I waste this? Do I sit here and be sociable and eat it? It's particularly hard if you're somewhere where it's a hostess giving you too much, and there's no way you can do it, can, you know, not receive it and not take it. and yet you know your body doesn't need it. Or maybe you don't know your body. I mean, you can even be taught not to hear what your body's saying anymore and say to yourself, I need that, I need that, I need that. And maybe you don't need it physically, you need it mentally at this point. And you see, we teach children how to do that by either rewarding them for being good eaters. You know, what's a good eater? A good eater should be somebody who eats what they need. But how can I determine what some three-year-old needs? We do that all the time. It's a lack of trust, and this again diminishes a child's self-esteem because it says, you're only three, you don't know how much to feed yourself. Well, how come he knew how much to feed himself at 3 months? But at 3 years, he doesn't know how much to feed himself. Well, the reason he doesn't know how to feed himself anymore maybe is because he has learned that if I eat the amount mother wants me to, she'll like me, or I can control mother by not eating this. See, I can really get her to look at me and pay a lot of attention to me if I don't eat this. We knew a child one time who was, 8, 10 years old, who ate nothing but hamburgers and milkshakes. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That is all that child would eat. The parents took her to a psychiatrist who gave this very sage advice that you'd think any parent would automatically know. Put the food out and don't say anything. If she doesn't eat, forget it. You know, there's a strong urge to live in every human being. It's a really strong urge. It's a very hard urge to kill. And you can trust that urge in your children, that if you don't tell them how much to eat or what to eat, but you know, they'll probably eat. They'll probably really eat enough to keep themselves going. Now, where does the control come in then? Where do you need to control? What? Somebody say. Absolutely. If you're going to be the one who's cooking the meals and doing the buying, you need to learn as much as you can about human nutritional needs, and then you buy only that. Which means, like, you probably don't buy Oreos and Coke and, stuff that we know for a fact is not good for us, like what's labeled junk food. You know, well, why do we buy that? I buy it because I like it. For years, I bought Coke and I hid it. I had bridge mix, which I knew wasn't good for me, but you see, I had been taught, that's a treat, chocolate's a treat, okay? I kept the bridge mix up above the stove, and when there was no kid around, I'd reach up and get some and put it in my mouth, and somebody came in, I said, Mommy, can you, what time is it? It's 4 o'clock, honey. Because I didn't want to teach my kids to eat this stuff that I had learned was a treat. You know, let me ask you, why do we call things that aren't good for kids a treat? You ever do that? I do that all the time. I try to catch myself. It's a treat. What, if you eat all your smoothies, your whole meal, I'll give you a brownie. Why are you giving a kid a brownie? It's not good for him. So why don't you say to him, honey, if you eat the brownie, you'll get the smoothies and the mashed potatoes. Doesn't that make more sense logically? You know, because when I get to my age, I can't eat brownies anymore. Last night I did this dumb thing. I ate that dessert instead of eating more cheese and bread. No, that was not good for me. The dessert had lots of sugar in it. It had a lot of white flour, no doubt. All kinds of calories I didn't eat. I should have eaten the other stuff that was more nutritional. Why do I do that? It's not good for me. I don't have any self-control. Why didn't I learn that? I don't want to teach my kids that. Okay, but you see, we do that. We do it by default, mostly. Very intentionally, we are teaching children to value the food that isn't good for them because we give it as a reward. If you're good while I'm shopping, we'll get offended. You know, if you behave while Grandma's here, I'll give you a lollipop. Okay, if you eat your dinner, you get a cookie. Who doesn't need a cookie? If they don't ever know about cookies, they're happy. I remember one time a woman said to me, can I give your child a cookie? The kid was 22 months old. I said, I'd rather you didn't, please. She said, what? No cookie? I said, no, I don't give him cookies. You don't give him cookies? I think that's cruel. I said, listen, did you miss television before it was invented? She said, no, of course not. I said, he doesn't miss cookies. He doesn't know about cookies. You know. This kid is an adult now, and he still doesn't eat dessert very much. He has to really be a yum-yum, like a chocolate brownie with lots of ice. Now, where did he learn that? okay, where do we get our self-concept? We got to move on here. I told you I talked too much. Self-concept comes from the quality of the relationship of the child and those who play a significant role in his life. Now, for the early years, mother is usually the most significant other. Father is the second most significant other. In some families, that isn't true, but generally speaking. It may be a babysitter who's the most significant other if she's got that child more hours than mother does. But the self-image of the parent has been found in research to be the most significant variable. And this is where I feel like, you know, we really can have some control over this. Because if your self-image is low, you're not going to be able to raise kids with a high self-image. So what can you do about that? You have to say, oh, I'm going to be a failure as a parent. I've got a low self-image. What am I going to do? You don't need to do that. You can say to yourself, what can I do to change my self-image? And as Christians, I think the main thing to zero in on is the fact that if God made me and gave his son to die for me, I can have high self-image and I can stop listening to all this junk that everybody is feeding me that says, you're not so hot. You know, you're not doing a very good job. You don't look the way you should. You're not developing the way you should. You can zero in on the fact that, why is that person telling you that? There are two questions you can ask. Number one, is that person telling you that because he has an ego need and he's got to be on top of me, so he tells me I'm no good, that makes him feel better? We do that all the time. I call that the seesaw effect, you know? If I'm down on a seesaw, how do I get up? I push you down, right? We do that all the time. We put other people down and it gives us a temporary lift and we feel a little superior. If you have high self-image, you don't have to go around giving people put down. So the more you zero in on the fact that you are God's creation and therefore you are of inestimable worth, then you can say to yourself, I don't have to listen when that person says that. Maybe I can ask myself, why does that person feel like they have to give me a put down? Now, the other point is, maybe I should listen to that put down and say to myself, gee, maybe I was like that. And if I am like that, do I want to be like that? Maybe that person says to me, well, you're really unkind. That was a nasty remark. Then I can say to myself, now wait a minute, was that really an unkind remark? And if it is, do I want to be a person who goes around giving other people nasty remarks? And if I don't want to be that way, I can stop doing that. I can maybe concentrate on this week, or maybe just today, I'm going to stop saying nasty things to other people. Okay, and the very fact that I do that is going to raise my self-esteem because it'll say to me, you've got some control over what's going on around you. So, it's really important, though, to worry about what your own feelings of self-worth are, because if they're low, it's going to be very hard for you to convince the children you're raising that they're okay. And that's because we just automatically raise our own self-feelings by putting other people down. And little people are so much easier to put down than big people, aren't they? You know, there's not much they can do about it. Sometimes they smart off back to us. And then we just give them another put down and another one because they can't get away from it. So the self-concept of the parent is extremely important because of the large amount of time that we spend with small children and because of the power of modeling. You model to the person, I feel good about myself. One of the ways that it's very important to do that is to think positively about who you are and what you're doing, but also to say it out loud when you're with little people. If they can't tell what you're thinking, they can hear what you're saying. But if you want to model how to have high self-esteem to a little person, you've got to do that with words and actions so that they can hear it and they can see that model. If you just think to yourself, oh, shoot, I spilled the juice again. Oh, well, I can clean it up. Instead of thinking to yourself, spilled the juice again. I am such a clumsy nitwit. You see, if you think it, the child doesn't know what you're thinking. But if you say to yourself, oh, I spilled the juice. Well, that's okay. I'll just get a sponge and clean it up. That's not such a big deal. Then the child hears that, and that makes it okay for him to spill juice and know that. Then you go clean it up, and you don't say to yourself, you're just a real dum-dum because you spill juice. Okay?
I spill juice this morning.
Did we ask her what she said to herself?
I don't remember.
You thought about losing the juice and didn't give yourself a foot down, and you say, oh, what's everyone thinking of me? An adult still in juice? One of the most fun times for me when I had a nursery school for a period of time was the first time any of the children would spill their juice. Because, you know, they'd knock it over and then they'd go, you know, so what you going to say? Who's going to land on me? And we just say, there's a sponge on the sink, honey. And then they'd go, you mean I'm not going to get yelled at? And it was fun, because then they could wipe up this juice and they'd learn something about absorption. I mean, see, I understand absorption, so it isn't any big deal for me to wipe up a sponge, but for a three-year-old to use a sponge to wipe up spilled juice, that's a big, you know, cognitive, intellectual learning path. It's great. And sometimes they would spend the rest of the snack time mopping up the juice, squeezing it back out, mopping it up again. No, I mean it, really, because they were learning something about absorption. And what happened? The thing is, you had to watch that they didn't squeeze it back into the cup and drink it, because it quickly got gray after the second time around. Okay, so modeling how good positive feelings towards self out loud is important when you're working with little kids, because they can't tell what you're thinking. Self-concept is based on how the significant people in a child's life think and feel about the child's capabilities. If you think it's okay for a little boy not to be able to catch a ball, he'll feel good about himself. But if he gets the feeling like, there's really something wrong, an eight-year-old boy that can't catch a ball yet, that means I'm not good. It's how he gets treated then. Which means that we should avoid labeling and categorizing children, and always expect the best. Always expect the best. Even if this kid always blows it, you expect that. That's okay, and he really can handle it. One year, the theme up at Holden was also from the Old Testament, new every morning. I think that's the most beautiful thing to use with children. Doesn't matter what you did yesterday, how rotten you were, how much you misbehaved, today's a new day, and I'm assuming that you're just a super-duper kid today. If you treat kids like they're super-duper kids, they will respond and be as super-duper as they are physically and mentally capable of being. And then, you know, you have to know where their limits are and accept that, and not expect them to all be alike or measure up to some mythical standard that you've decided on. The first thing is, you know, how they are treated. The second thing is how they interpret how they are treated. The closer to reality that the child's expectations and picture of himself are, the higher his self-esteem will be, and that's true of all of us. You know, if you're expected, for instance, to grow up to be a concert pianist, and you really have very poor small muscle control, which you inherited from your great-grandfather, you see, you're in trouble, because you'll certainly not feel like you're a good person, because you can't achieve this goal that's set up for you. An example of that's rather extreme, but will give you the idea, is a friend of our daughter's who at one period in her life realized that our society very much values a woman who has large breasts. And she felt very low self-esteem, and she decided that if she just weren't totally flat-chested, that she probably would be an okay person. She talked her husband into selling his van, which he really needed, so that she had money for a breast expansion operation. And unfortunately, when she got all done with that, after a period of time, she began to realize that didn't make her feel any better about who she was. Now she was still a lousy person. She just had big boobs instead of little boobs, but she still was a lousy person. She ended up with, well, I won't tell you all the problems that the girl got herself into. Kids observe and they compare themselves with others constantly. They're constantly observing what other people are doing and comparing themselves either poorly or, you know, on a positive way. And this is why we need to operate a home that tolerates and encourages diversity. I really worry when I get a Christmas letter from a family that says the parents took the Lee Bowling Trophy this year and the five children all took this trophy and that trophy, and you think, really? Are all five of those kids all really interested in bowling? Or is that the only thing available to them? You know, did anybody say, wouldn't one of you like to take boys lessons? or, you know, wouldn't one of you rather have cross-country instead of bowling, or maybe somebody wants to learn to play an accordion. You know, things go in fads like that, and we tend to make available to our children the opportunities for things that we enjoy, instead of trying to figure out and you know, making all sorts of opportunities. That was one thing I liked about the Boy Scout program, is that in getting those merit badges, the kids were offered opportunities and all sorts of things that I'd never even thought about before. How we talk to children reflects how we feel. It's really hard to feel one way and express it on something else with kids. So, you know, it's important for us to value diversity in children. And again, isn't this biblical? If God made us all, he sure didn't make us all alike, did he? He gave many gifts and Paul speaks to this, and many, many gifts. And he doesn't rank them priority-wise, so maybe it's all right. But I remember one of my students one time said to me, and I was just floored, this was in a public school, she said, oh, she said, I'm praying for you that the Lord will give you the gift of speaking in tongues. And I said to her, well, you know, I feel like maybe the Lord gave me the gift of being a teacher. And you know, maybe I don't get these other gifts. Maybe this was the gift that he gave. And she said, oh, I know he did. I know he did. I think she suddenly realized that, you know, that maybe the gift that she was choosing for me was not the one that God had in mind for me. And maybe it isn't up to us to decide which gift we're going to get. And just be grateful for the one we get and use it. But we need to watch our children to see which gift they're being given and help support that instead of saying, but I really wanted you to be a minister. You know, I don't like it that you want to be a dancer. That isn't socially acceptable in our family. So children form images of themselves from the verbal input, and it's therefore important for us to think about how we talk to children and to practice talking to them in ways that build positive self-concept and encourage self-esteem. And I think you can ask yourself a question when you're ready to say something to a kid. Will the words I'm choosing to say encourage or discourage this child? Because you can get across the same point in ways that are encouraging and in ways that are discouraging kids. You need to practice making statements to children which judge behavior rather than the person. And isn't this exactly what God does for us? You know, he judges our behavior, but he loves each of us in spite of us. And I think if we can just remember to do that with the kids, and it's the way you say it that makes the child assume that he's a bad person or that the behavior is not what he wants. One way you can do this is to make I statements rather than you statements, instead of saying, boy, you know, you are really a lousy kid because you were supposed to come in and do the dishes and you didn't do it. Or you can say, hey, I thought the dishes were going to get done and I see they're still sitting in the sink. You know, that just tells what you think and feel. And that allows the child to be in control of what he's going to think and feel. You're labeling naughty behavior that I see in the daycare center, at least, or in my school situation, is because kids want attention. And they do not do this because they know that it's a bad thing to do. They do it because it meets the need. It gets their needs met, which is attention. Narnia must be out. Well, we'll talk more about that when we get into discipline. You know, why children do these kinds of things. But it's really important to say to them things that don't label them as bad people and let them decide if the behavior was what they want to do, so that they have an image of themselves as a good person who wants to please.
I remember that when we went to Colorado and the swimming pool was filmed, I think she jumped in
Okay, we'll talk more about that too tomorrow. We're going to talk about feelings and then we'll get into discipline, because I think that a knowledge of how self-esteem is formed and some thinking about how we handle feelings precedes a discussion of discipline, because how you discipline is so much affected by those two things, or when you discipline, or whether you discipline. I like to talk a lot about, whether you really need to discipline, because I think a lot of things are like that, where a child is simply naive, and they do something because they really don't know any better, and if you treat it as a discipline thing, what kind of reaction does that set up for children? Okay, I guess we're supposed to stop, too, unless you want to dash over to lunch. I've talked too long. If you want to field any questions, quickly.